This is an interview with Lydia Ackrell and Joanne Thompson for the Hockey Museum. Today's date is Saturday, the 9th of September, 2023. We are in Joanne's mum's house in Twyford. The interviewer is Lydia, the interviewee is Joanne. Joanne, please, can we start with you saying and spelling your full name, please?
Yeah, my full name is Joanne Sarah Thompson, but most people know me as Jo. So you please refer to me as Jo from now on, because I think that's what everyone calls me. So name is spelled J-O-A-N-N-E, Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, Thompson, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N.
Lovely, thank you. And then can you also provide us with your date of birth, please?
Yes, it's 13th of May, 1965.
Lovely, thank you. So if we could start with your route into hockey, when did you start playing?
I started as a right back, playing for school. Our teacher, Angela Mitchell, was at the time the manager of the women's Slough hockey team, and her husband, Ian Mitchell, was the manager of the men's hockey team. So they were so into hockey. So anyone that was half decent, they took for the Slough team. So I started playing at school, Langley Grammar, and there was probably three or four other players coming from Langley Grammar onto Slough, and then I quickly quickly got involved with Slough, played for Slough thirds for a long time when I was about 15. So actually got into the environment and the highs and lows of being in a sports club, very early.
Okay, so when did you make that transition from hockey player to goalkeeper? Was that early on or was that later on in your career?
That was as early as possible. So okay. I didn't really want to play right back. I always wanted to play in goal, but Angela was insistent that I was half decent right back. It's hard to believe if anyone's seen me play on the pitch. But actually, I wanted to play in goal. I don't know why. I think I was quite competitive. Well, I am quite competitive. And I just knew that I could make a difference if I was in goal, because they used to just put people who didn't want to play hockey in goal. And actually, if they put somebody who did want to play and did want to win, I knew it would make a difference. So, and I also liked being a little bit different. There's something about me that doesn't. I love team sports, but I don't like all wearing the same kit. So it's kind of suited my personality. So as soon as possible, I convinced Angela to let me play in goal, and then started to play for Slough again, Slough thirds in goal for them.
Are there any notable memories that you've got from your club days, either as a player or when you then transitioned to goalkeeper?
It was just really, really fun times. That's what I remember. I just remember, for the first time, again, sort of 15, 16-year-old, being in an environment full of different people, adults, drinking, people from accountants through school teachers, and we were all equal. It was really strange to be treated like an adult when you knew actually you were a kid, but you weren't seen like that because you were just a hockey player. Loads of fun memories. It was all on grass at that time. We had to take our own, if we played at home, we had to take our own goals, lift them out of the shed, bring them onto the pitch, clean up any dog poo that was on the pitch first. So it was very, very amateurish, but I just remember lots of laughter. So yeah, good times.
Good. And did you have any rivalries against any other clubs that you played against?
Yeah, it was strange. So obviously when you were playing third team hockey, second team hockey, not so much. It was all local fun. You didn't normally play the same teams that often. When I started to play or be the reserve for the Slough first team and then play for Slough first team, our biggest rivalry was always Ealing. Sorry, Katie Dodd. But we really, we did everything we could to beat Ealing, especially indoor, because Ealing were supreme champions of indoor, and we never could get close to them for many years. And then one year, there's still a Slough song that's sung to this day because we managed to beat Ealing. The scoreline's got exaggerated over the years. I think it was probably 4-2, but it's become 8-1 in the song. So, but it was, yeah, they were our biggest rivals because we played mostly in the sort of South League. And then, obviously, years later, we played in the National League. And then it was always, Leicester were the big clubs at the time, Hightown, Sutton Coldfield, so there were more rivalries, and Ipswich as well, who I later played for.
Okay, when did you start playing for Ipswich?
So I played for Slough for sort of 10, 15 years, and then I played for Ipswich from sort of 1992 onwards until I finished, which was 2000, I think.
You touched on it a little bit there about indoor hockey. So did you find it very different playing indoor versus outdoor when you were on the grass?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was indoor was my game. So I managed to get into the England senior squad when I was 19, or 18, in fact. It was just, as a goalkeeper, you're just so involved in the game. It was so fast, it was so quick, it was just amazing. It highlighted the skills of the players. It was higher scoring. It was probably a better game to watch as well, because we used to play the national finals in Crystal Palace. So every year, hopefully, if we didn't get knocked out by Ealing, we'd go to Crystal Palace and have crowds, which in those days was quite a thing, because normally on a Saturday you wouldn't, on an outdoor game, you'd get the sort of girlfriends, boyfriends, a couple of local press watching, but nothing else. So yeah, it was a great game.
And was hockey the only sport that you played?
At school, I did a little bit of everything else. I'm not that sporty, not naturally. So it's interesting. I think once I picked up hockey, and especially hockey goalkeeping, I was absolutely focused on becoming better, and I would watch other goalkeepers. So when we played other games, I would spend my time just watching to see even the very, very basic things that people were doing, to see what was good about them, what wasn't good about them. I became quite obsessive about it in a way that, it's like I was always thinking about it, and I was always thinking about different ways of training, trying to learn from other people. Trying to understand, what could stop a goal going in. So it became a kind of fascination. I enjoyed other sports. Again, not particularly good at them. I played tennis. Now I do a little bit of cycling and walking. So, but hockey was really the thing that I absolutely, once I got into it, absolutely loved. So.
From the other people that I've listened to, their interviews, one of the challenges of being a hockey player is funding that career and getting the equipment and things. Did you have the same kind of challenges, especially being a goalkeeper? Would you have to provide all that extra equipment that you needed to wear?
Yeah, and as a goalkeeper, I mean, the equipment has moved on, to such a high level. So when I first started playing, I played in our school kit, which was sort of metal toe-capped boots and wicket keeper pads, so white wicket keeper pads that I used to take home every weekend and whiten up to make sure that they look really clean. And then I remember on my 16th birthday, my mum's mum, my nan, bought me my own set of these white pads and kickers, and I was just so amazed. It was just the nicest present anyone can buy me, and I looked after these, as much as anything. And then between my mum and Angela Mitchell, my PE teacher, they made me a chest guard, because we didn't have any other padding at the time. So we had boots, kickers, we had cricket pads, we had a pair of gloves, and I can't even remember what they were made of, but they weren't particularly thick, didn't have any head covering, or chest pads or arm pads. But Angela and my mum made me my own chest pad. But, the embarrassing thing was the back of it was made out of my dad's jock strap. Every time I tied it up, I was thinking, to them, it was fine. They just used what they had. And it worked. I even played an England indoor match in that chest pad. And then from then on, quite early, I was very lucky to get sponsorship from Mercian. And that, that really, really did save me, because, at the time it was expensive, and it is even more expensive now. So, I know a set of pads and kickers can cost £1,000. So it's not accessible to a lot of people. So from, you know, again, I was lucky from an early age to get sponsorship, so it meant that every year or every 2 years I'd get a full set of kit. And, you know, working with some of the manufacturers to develop the kit further. So we worked with Monarch to change the handguards, because the handguards, you know, every goalkeeper at the time had broken fingers. It was just one of those things. But, and as players got stronger and stronger, you know, the ball was going faster and faster, so you needed better equipment. So we eventually, you know, had sort of high density foam, same for the kickers, same for the pads. Everything was really light. You then got, you know, proper body protection and a full helmet. So from the day I started with, you know, just, you know, very, very basic equipment to the day I finished, which was, you know, almost totally covered. You know, mobility's not as great, but yeah, you didn't get the injuries you used to get when I started playing.
So when did these changes start to come in? Would it have been like the 80s and 90s?
So 80s, it started to come in 80s. For the Barcelona Games, it was really just on the cusp of changing, but the kit was still quite so new then that a lot of the time the umpires would check it and deem it illegal. So take it off for you and you'd have to use something else, because like anything new, people would sort of challenge, is that fair or not fair? It wasn't about, you know, trying to get super sized gloves to stop the ball going in. It was about really protecting people from getting injuries. So 80s and 90s. I don't think it's changed that much over the last 10, 15 years from what I can see, but I'm sure there's probably some little tweaks that have made it a little bit safer and from the mobility easier. And the other thing that we did suffer with, you know, with all that foam on, when you're playing in a hot environment, it was incredibly hot. So you could lose, you know, a couple of litres of water quite easily just because you're, you know, just from standing around, which you did most of the time in goal.
So we can talk a little bit more about the games that you played and the tournaments that you were involved in. Yeah. Do you remember when you were first selected to play for England and your memories of this?
I remember the first time I wasn't selected, which was when... So as I said, at Langley Grammar, there was three of us who were super keen on sport. And one of my closest friends, Sarah Lennon, and now Sarah Rimmer, was selected for England under 18. And myself and Michelle Scott, the other player for Slough, weren't happy for her, I should say. I mean, we were just extremely jealous. We were just absolutely, and Sarah was so proud. I remember, you know, looking back, it's such an unfair thing to feel. You know, she came in with her England stick bag, and we were just so jealous, but we couldn't voice that. So I remember, and I can't even remember if I was close to a selection or not, but just, you know, that kind of jealousy probably did spur me on. And then, but shortly after that, I was selected for the England indoor team. I was just shocked. You know, I was shocked to get into a senior team before I got into any junior team. But then I was selected for England and under 21s in the same year as Jane Sixsmith. You know, was just coming through. Lisa Baylis was there. So there was quite a few people who went on to be sort of full internationals. My first senior England outdoor selection was the same day as Hillsborough disaster. We were up in Liverpool playing against Ireland, and a game we should have won, and we drew 1-1, probably my fault for the goal. So not a great first cap. But then the dinner in Liverpool that night, it just, you know, so traumatic because so many families were involved in Hillsborough and everyone knew somebody. It just really, it was a very memorable occasion for the wrong reasons, but great to get it out of the way kind of thing. I was very honoured to be chosen and picked. And then for Great Britain again, I remember not getting picked before I got picked. At the time, I was playing England number one. We just won the European trophy in Belgium, so it was 1991. So I was probably at the peak of my career. And then for the 92 Barcelona Olympics, the Olympic qualifying tournament was in New Zealand, and I wasn't selected, but the goalkeeper, who was then the second choice in England, was selected above me. So again, I found that really hard to understand why that was, until I understood the coach a little bit more and his mentality and his values, as far as he saw me as very aggressive, very not with the right attitude, which was sort of kind of strange to me, because I thought it was all about winning. But he had a much, you know, broader, holistic view of what hockey should be like.
So when the coaches were selecting goalkeepers then for these games, what qualities were they looking for?
Who knew? I mean, that's a really interesting question, because I don't think a lot of the time, certainly at junior level, the goalkeeper who was the busiest was the one that was selected. So you might be stood down one end and the ball never came to you, so you wouldn't get selected. You couldn't prove yourself. They didn't watch you in training in the early days. It was very, very strange. And I do maintain that actually a really good goalkeeper doesn't touch the ball as much as a not so good goalkeeper, just because they are controlling, you know, they're guiding their players in front of them, so they shouldn't see the ball as much. So it was a little bit, you know, I think there was a little bit of, you know, people knowing other people from a goalkeeper perspective. Oh, yes, you know, that player's good. So you'd get the same people being selected, because you only had a small window of opportunity at those trials to show yourself, because there were trials at those times before they had, you know, now you have camps and you have the ability to sort of train and play and you know, mix in. So the challenge is to get into those camps, but now but then it was really purely, okay, you're going to England trials, it's a weekend, and you'll play some selection matches. So you'll be put in a random team, and then how you perform would depend on whether you got in or not. So that's how I remember. And it was always a little bit of a lottery whether you got in or not. And always just such a horrible way to find out, because you were in a room and they'd read through a list alphabetically. And you had to work out, oh, have they gone past my name or not? You know, for me, have they picked another goalkeeper already? And then, you know, some people were sort of devastated, you know, with big events, that your name would be read out or not read out. That, you know, if it was your life, which sounds a little bit exaggerated, but it was your life, you lived for it. It was absolutely devastating. You know, I felt that, and I've seen other people go through that. I've seen people do it with such dignity. And I've seen people do it, you know, who just literally stormed out and, you know, couldn't hold their emotions. And I was probably, sadly, one of the second type of people. I remember Mandy Davis from Sutton Coldfield, still in my mind, is one of the most dignified players, because she was, you know, she just missed out on Barcelona selection, but she was so, so dignified and so collaborative and encouraging for everyone else. You know, and it just shows, you know, what quality person she is.
So do you think your maybe goalkeeping style or the attitude that you had towards goalkeeping, was that different to the people that you'd been around?
Yeah, I mean, it's strange. When you're a goalkeeper, you know, you often get people coaching you who aren't goalkeepers. And you have to learn to just pick different things up. So my style was different, because I was keen to not just learn from people who've done it before, but to find my own way of doing it. And I just wanted to cherry pick from lots of different people. So I was fascinated when anyone talked about goalkeeping in any way, in any sport as well. So, you know, ice hockey, I used to watch goalkeepers. Football, I used to, just for the positioning and just understanding. Anything I heard, I'd try and cross-relate it to something else I'd heard. So I always did want to just find my own way. And I think I do that. You know, I think I love learning in life, but I always want to discover that learning myself. So I'm not somebody, you know, who does a master's degree or even does a degree, because I want to kind of find a way, which seems strange, but, you know, it's still it's still a passion for learning, but just not this sort of official learning, more sort of self-discovery and finding things and trying things. So, I remember one of the best coaches I ever had was a goalkeeper, and he was our Slough coach at one point, Phil Williams. And I just used to love listening to he played for Wales. I used to love listening to his stories about, you know, the best save he ever made, or what he did here, what he did there. And then John Clark, who coached us for Great Britain, again, a goalkeeper, full of stories, full of little, you know, anecdotes about, you know, what I did to this striker. And as a goalkeeper, when you're speaking to other goalkeepers, you do understand kind of the mentality. And it's, you know, we are a slightly different breed, because we're sort of stopping and, you know, yes, we can create, but we're more about stopping other people creating. And it is the psychology between a striker and a goalkeeper or anyone attacking. So I can't even remember what the question was then, but
that's
yes.
Okay. Just about your approach as a goalkeeper. Yeah. How did it make you feel then? When you were being coached by people that weren't goalkeepers, how did you manage that? Was it more difficult to kind of take their instruction than if it was a goalkeeper telling you what to do?
I think there's always something to learn from anyone. Though my approach is everyone has got something. So even if somebody was kind of telling you things that you didn't necessarily... I never disagreed with whatever somebody was telling me, but I always would take it on, try it, and then just, you know, maybe do it another way if I didn't think that was the best way. The only time it really upset me was one time in you know, we did employ somebody in England who was just, it was a bit slow. It was a bit, you know, it was very routine. We did the same thing at every training session. But then it's up to you as a player just to try and influence the coaches to try and get something else that, you know, into the conversation to say, you know, we need a little bit without disrespecting the coach in any way. And I think we managed to sort of change it around slightly so we got more involvement with the players. But I do believe, you know, everybody's got stuff to learn. And you can learn a lot from... You can learn a lot from field players, outfield players, because actually they're the ones that see the other side of it. So, you know, you can listen to what they feel like when they see sort of that it's just them, the goalkeeper, you know, what kind of things you need to do to make the chances of you saving the ball, you know, easier. So again, you know, Angela Cannell was somebody from Ealing who did a little bit of coaching when we were in England under 21, not a goalkeeper, but, you know, very, very good advice around what you can do and what you can't do, how it makes the person on the ball feel.
So going back to some of the games that you've played, can you talk me through some of the memories that you've got of your 1991, the European Championships?
Yeah, that was a great, great championships. So it's in Brussels. We had a couple of injuries beforehand. So Kirsten Spencer was sort of out last minute. Jane Smith came into the squad. A mixture of, you know, a real sort of mixture of ages and experience. I don't think we were favourites at the time. The Dutch and the German teams were both really, really strong. But we had a really nice team, a nice, you know, a coaching team as well. We had a great physio called Jerry who used to take us on these little mobility circuits every morning around sort of the parks of Brussels. And it was just a really, you know, there was a few people reaching their peak at that time. So, you know, Jane Sixsmith was playing really well. Tammy Miller was playing really well. I was playing really well. Vicky Dixon, Sandy Lister, you know, there were some players who were absolutely just at their peak. We went out there with some very little expectations. We were having quite a nice time out there. It wasn't as professional as it is now, as far as, you know, we were given a lot of free time. We went to the cinema, you know, all the time because we were right next to the cinema. It was Silence of the Lambs had just come out. Remember that? And we hadn't heard of Silence of the Lambs, so we all went in to watch it, not knowing what it was, thinking it was a nice little, maybe a romantic film. And it was just this horrific film that I think gave us all nightmares for the next couple of nights. But it was great. I mean, during the tournament, as we played, we lost a few players, lost a few key players. At the time, the rules had changed, so you could chip the ball into the net, which and a couple of our players had got broken thumbs on the line, so I take full responsibility for that because I should have saved it first. And it was a game. It was a tournament where I just remember that we were very lucky, and you need luck in tournaments, but also very determined and very, very together. And we won the semi-final on penalties against the Dutch. Again, you know, they didn't have their best team. I did everything I could very subtly to put them off their penalties. Nothing outrageous, but just little things, just by sort of moving beforehand or giving them the ball, or okay. just you know, very subtle things. And we scored more than they did. And then in the German game, we've seen the video probably a few years after we won. About 10 years after we won. So we were playing Germany. They were all over us completely. Should have won. I think Jasper got the ball, so James Fismuth got the ball a couple of times and scored both times. Just, it was complete, you know, a game not like it. So we were outclassed, outplayed, but we won. And I think that kind of game then feels so much better, especially as a goalkeeper, because you've been involved. It's like you've been, I thought I was quite good in that game. And then I watched the video and I just realised I was just incredibly lucky. So the ball was pinging off the posts or pinging off a defender, or it would hit me, but I didn't know anything about it. But it's just one of those games that will always live with me. The saddest thing is we were flying out the same night. So normally, you know, we didn't get many chances to celebrate for England, but that was, you know, our one big chance. So, and we just were so happy, and we had people, you know, players with arms in slings. Obviously, you don't drink during a tournament, but we were having a beer at the end. It was just so much fun. But then we had to get on a plane, come home, and it was the one night we really wanted to sort of just have a party and celebrate together.
When you won gold in that, then I think I might be wrong, but it was the first European gold medal for either men's and the women's. Then was that correct?
Or? I don't know. Okay. I don't know. Not a huge historian. I would have thought the men might have won it before.
Okay. Okay.
I think it probably was the first for the women.
So was that? Did that feeling add to that?
No.
Sense of celebration, or was it just?
No. Yeah, I don't think you. I don't think when you're playing, you're aware of any significance of what doing. And maybe that's me. I mean, everyone's different. From my point of view, I was just, when you get a team that feels more like a club team, because you know each other, then the joy of winning something. So it's not about winning for England. Okay. It's just about winning with that group of players. So I think there's nothing better than winning at club level, because you do know everyone so well. You know, you've got so much trust and you know, the relationships that go back longer and stronger. If you can replicate that at any time in a international sports team, then you're lucky. And I think probably that Brussels team was the closest. You're not going to like everyone. We're all different within that team. However, when you accept those differences and just, you know, just enjoy each other's company, and there's a lot of, you know, just gentle humour, just gentle teasing with each other, that's like a family almost. When you can get to that stage with the team, I think then winning feels magical, and losing doesn't feel quite as bad either, because you have got people around you.
So after that then, is it the 92, was the Barcelona Olympics. Can you talk through your memories of that event?
Yeah, it's interesting. After getting knocked back to go to the Olympic qualifier, I wasn't expecting to go to Barcelona. I say that, I did expect it in some ways, because when I was 15, I went to Carnaby Street and I had my palm read, and the palmist told me that I'd be in the Olympics. So I had an incredible belief, based on complete fiction, that I would go to the Olympics. And I always knew I would go to the Olympics. Now, this might sound a little bit crazy, I'm sure it does, but actually, I don't know whether that was true or not. He did say a few things that actually were also true. However, I had a belief in me, not necessarily a cockiness, but just a strong belief that I would go to the Olympics. So getting knocked back for the Olympic qualifier, I thought, well, it would be 5 years' time then. Getting into the Barcelona Olympic squad, I was quite shocked. I was delighted, but I didn't think I'd be the first choice goalkeeper. I didn't think I'd play. So fantastic to get selected. Absolutely joyous moment. One of the, that was the biggest thing in my life ever. I was going, my girlfriend at the time was in the team, so it was absolutely lovely, completely, not out in the sort of general public terms, but it was just so great that we could both go together. I remember my mum and dad saying, oh, we're going to come. And I said, well, I won't be playing. You're welcome to come to Barcelona, but I won't be playing. Which was quite a relief to my mum, because she doesn't like to see me play because she gets all too worked up. My dad was like, well, that's a shame, but we'll come anyway. And I remember the night before the first game against the Dutch, the team selection was done, and they read my name out to start. I was thinking, oh no, I'm not quite ready for this. I was really ready, but I was just suddenly thought, I wasn't expecting it at all. Really, really not expecting it at all. And then to play and to walk out onto that pitch, and it was a beautiful, beautiful pitch, a beautiful stadium. And my mum and dad, I could hear them literally. They were behind me. So this a big stadium. I think it was 15,000, but again, still hockey, still a bit of a niche sport at the time. Early games and the rounds, it wasn't in Barcelona. It was in Terrassa, so there wasn't a huge amount of people there. So they were able to get really close to me, which was great. That's just what you want. And as we were warming up, I could hear my mum say, oh, she's playing. I think she's playing. Like panic in her voice. Will she be all right? Thinking, if you need any sort of reassurance that you're good, you're strong. So luckily we had a psychiatrist at the time, a sports psychologist who had given us some preparation as far as how to feel some confidence in time when you're just thinking, oh my word, what's going to happen? So I was just sort of chanting to myself. But it was something that really, really did, was a fantastic event. Again, hockey doesn't get a lot of funding. Suddenly we were getting all these free things. Suddenly we were getting suitcases with, all this free kit, not just kit to play in, but kit to walk around the village in. It was just amazing, absolutely amazing. And just to be in that village with all the different sports people, all the different shapes and sizes, all the different, races and religions, it was just fantastic. And everybody there for, just to enjoy sport. So
how does that experience then compare to, was it the next one, which was, is it 96 Atlanta Olympics?
Yeah.
So how would you compare the two?
Well, people who've been to two or three Olympics, always say your first one's always the best. I think Barcelona was fantastic. It was a great place. It was a good team. It was new and exciting for me, fully involved in all of the, all of the games apart from the last game. I didn't play in the last game, but I played all of the ones up until we won the medal. So really, really sort of felt included in the team. And we won something. We came back home with a medal. And it wasn't a gold medal, it wasn't a silver medal, but it was a medal. And that meant so much more. And we were invited to things because we had a medal. And that's why you go there. So Atlanta, we came away with nothing. We came fourth. We came third in the table. And it was the first time they played everyone in the league. And if they'd stopped there, we would have got a bronze. But then they decided to have the playoff games. And, we lost on penalties to the Dutch. So I don't know why. I didn't play as much. And that was a game I expected to play. I expected to start, and I didn't start. Hilary Rose was in much better form than I was. She started, you know, she should have started.
Was she a goalkeeper?
She was a goalkeeper, okay. Yeah. So, but I was probably, I probably thought I was going to start. So it was a very different experience for me personally. You know, one games I thought I wouldn't start, and I did play, and we won something. And the other one I expected, not expected, but I just thought I had a good chance of playing. I didn't play until the last few games when she was injured. And at that time, there weren't any rolling subs. And certainly as a goalkeeper, you weren't, you know, you were either playing or you weren't playing. So it was a time where, actually, if you weren't selected, you were sat on the bench. So, yeah, I'm much... And also, you know, it was still quite amateurish in 92. It started to get a bit too serious for Atlanta. So, you know, we were paid to train, which actually I didn't really like. I quite liked working and then training in the evenings and training at weekend, and everyone was kind of at the same level. So it was a strange mix of semi-professional, I'd say, still, but a lot more professional than when we were in Barcelona.
You touched upon the rolling subs there. So how did it make you feel when you were sat knowing that you were just on the bench for that game? Were you sometimes agitated when you think, oh, I could make a difference, or you're seeing something going on in the game that you couldn't control? Or
I think it's very much dependent on the game. So, okay. You know, in some games, you know, I remember the Barcelona, the medal match, and Budgie playing, you know, I was just willing her to do well and willing the team to do well and just so enthusiastic behind them. You know, when you think you're going to play and you don't, I think, depends on the type of person you are. I mean, I didn't handle it very well. I've learnt a lot since then, but, you know, at the time I was just devastated. And I should have been able, you know, I was saying the right things, but I just knew that I wasn't saying with the emotion I should have had. You know, I should have been all about the team, and I was kind of going through the motions. So yeah, you do feel you want to play, and that's why any sport,
that's why you're there.
Yeah, exactly.
In recent GB games, goalkeepers play alternative quarters. Would you have liked to play like this, or would you rather how you used to play?
A good question. I would have struggled with that. I think I'd rather have played or not played and gone with the emotion of, you know, both of those. I think it's a little bit detrimental. You know, it says something about goalkeepers. You know, you there will be a better one. You know, there might. I understand people bringing in a different goalkeeper for shuffles, but, you know, just to switch them out randomly, I think that's you know, you wouldn't do that with players necessarily. So I think there will always be a stronger one. If you're giving experience to people, I think that's fair. And I think, you know, we used to do that in training games where you play the first half, I play the second half. Absolutely fine. Because we had halves in our days.
Can you tell me about any of the rivalries that you may have had with other goalkeepers? Well, did you have any rivalries with other goalkeepers?
Not really. No, most games and most goalkeepers, you know, we would applaud each other if we did good things. So there was a goalkeepers union, you know, absolutely. And as I say, I always wanted to learn and watch and see what other people do. We'd always, most of the time, speak to each other after games. I think the only rivalries were about then, you know, the international selection. So they got a little bit with certain people where you were close. So sometimes that, you know, people that I probably had rivalries with were, you know, Hilary Rose, but, you know, not until Atlanta, potentially. Val for GB early on. I think, most of the time it was supportive. We trained together, we'd have fun together. And it was just at those sort of pinch points during selection that you just felt a bit aggrieved or a bit relieved, whatever way it went.
Goalkeepers often complain about the defences in front of them, but is there anyone that you particularly admired or liked playing in front of you when you were in goal?
Yeah, I most of the people that played in front of me were, you know, much braver than I was, as far as, you know, going out there and facing a ball without any protection. So lots of different styles and different defenders, you know, I did admire. So from a sort of just a strength distribution perspective, when Tracy Fry in Ipswich moved back as a sweeper, he was always a midfielder or a striker in her early career. You know, strong, good vision, you know, great distribution of the ball. And then you had someone like Kath Johnson, who would work so hard and be like a terrier and never give up and just be so committed, through to someone like Vicky Dixon, who was just so skillful that actually if she picked the ball up in the defending D, she would be able to create something and you know, score a goal at the other end. So different people, I admire them all. The only ones I was ever frustrated with were players who would, you know, lose or hit the ball and then stop and put their hands on the hips. You know, and for me that was just like, okay, no, you always need to look for the next thing. And it was a lot more slow, you know, in the years that I played. You know, watching it now, it's just so fast and nobody could get away with that. But there was a little bit of that. You hit the ball, hands on the hips, sort of just, and start to talk to them. No, you're in the wrong position. If you can talk to one of our own players, you're in the wrong position. But that didn't, you know, that didn't happen often.
When you were playing hockey, you managed to juggle a job alongside your hockey representative career. Was this quite difficult to manage, or did you find it quite easy to do both?
I found it easy to do both because I could compartmentalise what I was doing. Last week I've been with the company that I started with when I was 18 for 40 years. I like to do things long term. But they were a very supportive company. So it was ICI and it's now PPG Industries. Really supportive of me playing sport. Gave me time off when I needed it. Most of it was holiday. You just got used to it. I think it's like anything. So I was used to every weekend, you know, from a Friday night to back on a Sunday, training. I was used to sort of, you know, I didn't necessarily push myself at work so much, so I wasn't in a position where I had to work silly hours. And my hours allowed me to, you know, finish work. You know, I'd sometimes train at lunchtime and I would often train after work, and there was always enough time. The minute you stop playing hockey or any sports, presumably, you think, how on earth did you do that? it's shocking. You think, I didn't have a minute to do other things, but you just love it. You're passionate about it. I think the toughest time is when you're injured and you can't train and you're sat there, you're not doing anything because you haven't got, you know, that is you've built your life around doing that, doing the training. So you're just really just, you know, that's miserable. But the rest of the time, no, it was absolutely fine. I loved it, and it never seemed too much. And work was, again, a different pace in those days. It wasn't quite as stressful. It gets more and more stressful as you get, you know, as your career progresses as well. But also, just different pressures, different things expected of you today.
So with players that are now full-time athletes playing today, they are able to just be full-time playing hockey. Mm. Would you have liked that opportunity, or did you like the way that you had it, where you worked alongside training and had time off for the tournaments?
I think I would have struggled, to be honest, if it was full-time. I always remember looking at Australia, because they were the only team in 92, I think, apart from Spain, who had done it for Barcelona Olympics. But Australia had the Institutes of Sports, and they would live together and they would train together. And they hated each other, absolutely hated each other. And it was because they spent so much time together. It wasn't, and there was nothing magical about being together and playing. It was almost like, okay, this is, you know, it's not a hobby, it's not a sport, it's my job. And it meant too much, you know, not to do well at your job, or not for somebody else not to do well. So I always had that kind of negative view of what it could be like. I'm sure it's much better now. I'm sure, you know, it's people get some time for themselves. But I did like the two lives, and they were quite separate lives. You know, I'd go back to work sometimes. You know, I remember after Brussels and we won the European Cup, nobody knew where I'd been or what I'd done. And I was quite happy with that. It was like, okay, that's my hobby. You know, few obviously close friends. Mm. Oh, how'd you go on? Well done. But, nobody really sort of was interested, or I wasn't that interested in them knowing about it. It was, and the same thing, I didn't necessarily talk much about work and my friends at work, because they are friends at work, to my hockey colleagues. It was just, they were separate lives. And I gave focus to each of them when I was there. So I think for me personally, it was a better way of having it. So I could show sort of different sides of myself in different places.
Moving on from your playing hockey career, I understand that you are in a same-sex relationship. Would we be able to talk about this within life and hockey?
Yes, thank you. Absolutely.
So when were you first aware of your sexual identity, and kind of what influenced you going through that coming out process?
Well, good question. I mean, it was different times, really, really different times. So, and, anyone of sort of my age, so 58, so in that kind of area, I was aware probably when I was 15, 16. But it was never spoken about. I mean, nobody... There was no role models. You didn't really know anything about it. I would go out with boys. And then as I got slightly older, it actually, Slough Hockey Club was a very, very safe space. So there were some gay women there. And there was one woman, and I have checked with her, it's okay to say this. Elaine Price was... She was married to a man. She then met a woman and fell in love. Very political at that time. So a lot of us weren't political. We were just trying to hide, trying to keep under the covers, not to be noticed in any way. She was completely different. She was out and proud at a time when people weren't out and proud. And to have that person, and I remember I was sort of coming through it, coming through the thirds and seconds, but I would see this group of first team players who were, and Pricey was there, and they were teasing Pricey and she was giving it back. They were just having so much fun, and this was a real mixture, mostly straight, but Pricey being out and proud, absolutely open conversations before other teams were having conversations or other societies were having conversations. And that really helped me, because to see somebody in that position, you think, actually, it's not so bad, it's not so awful. And it was, from a media point of view, that's all we heard. It was just a terrible thing. And I still struggle with the word lesbian to this day, because it was always an insult. It was always said to you, and it was unbelievable. As far as at work, I would be invisible, as far as people just assumed you're straight, because that's what everyone was. Yeah. So I would hear things that people would say about, most people didn't talk about it. It wasn't even a thing, kind of thing. But Slough Hockey Club and Elaine Price particularly made me see that actually it could be a life if I wanted that life. And then things just happened. So, I was in relationships again. People knew about it, but nobody spoke about it. But that's what we needed. An ally at the time in the hockey world was somebody who didn't gossip about you, didn't speak about you. We didn't know who was speaking about us and who wasn't, but we knew in Slough, we had a team of people who absolutely supported each other and didn't care about anyone's sexuality. It just wasn't a thing. The thing was friendship, the thing was playing hockey, and nothing else mattered. So you didn't know who was gay and who wasn't gay. There were rumours about it, but hockey was the safest space out of society, because it's in a club that cared. You knew you'd be all right, and with a positive role model, you knew you'd be all right. But there was, even in 92, after the 92 Olympics, there was an incident where two of the players in the team, one of them left her husband, and then went out with a player. It hit the newspapers on in Scotland in the Sunday Record, I think it was, that these two women had gone off together. So this was headline news. You know, two women fall in love. Great. Chris Evans on Radio 1 on the next morning, DJ, put a call out to everyone to say, oh, there's two lesbians in the Great Britain hockey team. There must be more than that. Ring in if you know. So, and I was driving into work thinking, oh my word. So, you know, I was still not really completely out. You know, my friends knew, but I didn't ever really speak about it. I was comfortable with it, but society wasn't comfortable with it. But to have that call out on national radio, I was then absolutely terrified. Because, again, my parents knew, but I never talked to them about it. It was just one of those invisible things that just happened, unless you were political, unless you were strong, unless you had complete conviction that, actually, you're probably more mature in life, that it was okay. So that was scary. That was a scary time. And I look back on that and you think, well, what was I scared of, really? But at the time, it did feel like threatening. And you know, Chris Evans might do many good things from now on, but I'm still not a fan.
In terms of your club setup, like, they sound really supportive and you were able to just kind of be yourself.
Yeah.
But when you compare that to the international setup and when you were away in the Olympics and the European Championships, was it different for you then? Did you have to kind of suppress who you were a little bit because of the different countries that you were in and around?
No, I mean, the funny thing is, you know, we didn't ever show any emotion to each other anyway, so there's absolutely nothing to suppress. And to this day, you know, with my wife, we live in the middle of nowhere. We walk down a lane, and if we go to hold hands, we still look around. And that is, you know, that is just because of how we were potentially made to feel. So from a player point of view, absolutely no different. You know, when you become friends, you just we have all got differences. We've all got things to be out about or not out about, you know, from family relationships through to, you know, who you love. So absolutely no issue there. And as a team, you stuck together as a team. You know, if anyone had a go at your player, you'd have a go, you know, from an international perspective. Coaches were a little bit different. And again, but just society, you know, so we were told not to speak about relationships, fear of sponsorship, you know, just deflect. We weren't going to anyway, but that was a strange thing. But it was funny to be told, actually, deny yourself, you know, and just being told to keep denying yourself isn't positive because it's saying, actually, who you are is not good enough. But again, it was the time. I do understand it, but it does have an effect on, you know, any gay person being told that they're not worthy and they need to hide who they are isn't a great message. So I'm very pleased that things have changed now. And you know, people can be people can just be themselves.
So was there any kind of LGBTQ plus community within hockey at the time that you were playing?
No. I mean, I think, you know, everyone kind of knew one or two gay players in each of the teams. I can't remember talking about them. Some people would tell me, oh, so-and-so's gay. But it wasn't like rumours, but it was just kind of the gay people kind of knew who each other were. But we there was no sort
of
community.
Like a community.
No, not at all.
No.
I mean, there were at the time there were a few sort of women's clubs in London. So you know, if there was sort of a couple of us who went there, we'd look. You know, sometimes we'd see somebody from another team, and it would just be a big surprise. But absolutely no community. You didn't want to be seen with anyone that was gay. You didn't want to be known as gay. You were kind of living this life thinking that everything outside was, you know, it was not real. It was a bizarre time. And that's why, you know, I think, you know, hockey has been really good in most clubs, in most countries, for gay people. But obviously, it does depend on what's happening in society and law. So
you mentioned a little bit about when you had, like, the media and the press conferences, you couldn't mention your sexuality because of the sponsorships and the challenges that might bring. Were there any other instances where you couldn't just be yourself within hockey because of the impact that it would have on your career or your club's career?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there was still people sort of with a little bit of internal shame about it, so you just didn't want to talk about any of those things. You deflected the whole time. You know, you didn't necessarily outright lie, but you just avoided things. So, anything that could bring any outing or conflict, you just stayed away from. And you just stayed in your own lane. And really, to people who wanted to know more, you just didn't give them anything. And that, again, that was me. We're all different. I'm sure some people were a lot stronger, would challenge it, or some people were even more, you know. I do know people who've denied themselves completely and sort of try to live a complete life. And certainly the generations that went before us, you know, there were women who were living together. So they were obviously in a relationship. But even though when we started to be a little bit happier and freer, they just couldn't talk to us. Because it was almost they denied it for so long, they'd lied about it for so long, it was kind of in their DNA now that they couldn't be gay, even though they obviously were. So I think it was difficult for me to start with. Not difficult for me. It was hard to be gay at the time, but I went through a period when it was absolutely completely acceptable. But for the generations beforehand, it was just completely, you know, they couldn't live a life externally in any way. It was a completely private life.
In, I think it was 1988, there was Section 28, which was banned the promotion of homosexuality by local authorities. That was like the words that the Act used. Did this have any effect on you at all?
It didn't directly. So again, Elaine Price, the activist she was, you know, marching against Section 28. She was working for one of the London boroughs at the time. Okay. The Conservative government were really, you know, fighting against this. You know, she was part of the loony left that was promoting homosexuality and corrupting all of our children. So it was a strange time because I wasn't directly aware. I'd left school by then, so, you know, wasn't affected by. Not that it was taught in school at all, or, you know, any mention of it in school, but to have so much negative news again about something, and some of the quotes from the House of Lords were absolutely, if you play them now, they're horrific about, you know, what they're saying about the corruption, the disease, you know, it's really, you know, you can't believe that people would say the things that they were saying during the debate of Clause 28. So it didn't directly affect me, but it did, you know, it did reinforce the message that gay is bad, you're not welcome. You know, it's something that you should be private about. You know, you're happy, but keep it to yourself. Even the don't ask, don't tell that came in the sort of the US Army. It's really about you can be yourself, but you know, you actually only just when you when you're on your own or when you're with your partner. Just don't tell. Nobody wants to know about that. So Section 28. I mean, I think so my wife has been in written a book about Clause 28 called Pretended, which is really interesting because there were teachers at the time and students at the time who were deeply affected by it and really felt that their lives would be, you know, especially if you're a teacher, you would potentially lose your job if you were gay. And that's not what the law was trying to do. You know, it's trying to just rid, it was state-sanctioned homophobia in a way, rid the whole world of any relationships or any talk about relationships. But teachers believed that it meant that if they were gay or they found out they were gay, they'd lose their jobs. So it was really, you know, any teachers at the time that were gay, and that's I think probably something that did affect it. You know, there were gay teachers who were playing hockey at the time, and they would never come out to a club with us. If there were something going on, the teachers would no way want to be involved and were probably even more uptight than we were. You know, we could relax in the club, we could relax in a hockey club, but they couldn't. You know, they were hyper sensitive. So yes, that's the only way it did affect me. But it was, you know, it was an awful law that came in, and it stayed in for 20 years, and it affected lots of teachers, and it affected so many students as well, because students who were obviously gay, who went to their teachers for help because maybe they couldn't go to their parents, got nothing, got rejection, got, you know, don't be daft, you know, you're a nice kid, you're straight. You know, it's, and from that, that's from a gay teacher. So it's really, really hard, and it has done a lot of damage to a lot of people in society, again, not in hockey specifically, but, you know, seeing people scared to be themselves is a very sad thing.
When was it Elaine Price, you said, when she was working in London and she was kind of working against Section 28, did she receive any backlash, or the club that she was playing for, did that, her actions to try and work against it, were, did she suffer in any way because of that, or was she just, she just got on with it because of who she was?
Yeah, who she was, she wasn't a teacher, but she was sticking up for the rights of people, just, you know, very, very, you know, militant in her viewpoint, as far as, you know, this isn't right, this is not something that as a society we want to accept. So from a Slough hockey point of view, she just got teased about it, you know, with just a little bit of ribbing, and but she wouldn't,
but it didn't negatively impact her hockey career.
Not at all. I'd say no, we, again, as a family, we wouldn't have let that happen. And she wouldn't,
So this act was in place for 20 years. And when the government tried to undo the change, the act, and kind of like remove the negative impact that it had on society, did you start to see any changes? Did it become easier as they were trying to work to undo that act?
They didn't do a very good job of undoing it. Okay. I mean, in fact, what they did is apparently they wrote out to head teachers, but, you know, surprisingly few know that it's not, well, not now, but I mean, it didn't know it had been repealed. Okay. You know, the news it'd been repealed, I think, only went in one newspaper. I think it only went in The Guardian, and everywhere else it was just silence. People still thought it was there for years afterwards. I think, you know, society's changed, you know, equal marriage coming in, you know, those big changes, even civil partnerships before that, you know, people started to see that actually we're talking about love here, we're not talking about, you know, there's no threat to anyone else, you know, just it's fine, you know, it's absolutely fine, people aren't trying to convert anybody or do anything devious, it's just about love, so just leave it like that, you know, and accept people's lives. So I don't think, you know, it came in with, you know, a lot of noise and a lot of support from some quarters, a lot of publicity, but it went out very quietly and very subtly. Mm. Whether you know, at the time society had changed so much, actually it wasn't that relevant, or actually whether it was just, you know, it's a Conservative government at the time, not sure.
Do you think being gay over this time period that you were active, do you think it was easier as a woman being gay than it was a man?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, and I always thought that, you know, at the time, you know, in the sort of late 80s with the AIDS epidemic, it was terrifying being a man. And I think, you know, men got a lot more prejudice. You know, women are comfortable with other women's sexualities. Women don't feel threatened by other women, gay women. And I think that's the joy of women's sport. You know, you can be different and nobody thinks, oh, you know, she's going to be after me. No, if you're straight, you're straight. If you're gay, you're gay. That's it. I think men, certainly during that time, were completely obsessed with other men, you know, attacking them. But, you know, and again, that wasn't going to happen, but it was kind of the fear. And then with AIDS, it was made it even worse. You know, they're not only going to attack me, they're going to kill me. It was, yeah, really, really hard for gay men. I don't know any gay men that play hockey. I didn't, you know, I'm sure I've met some gay men that play hockey, but during that time they would have been completely undercover, probably married to a woman, you know, just probably lying a complete, leading a complete double life. So, yeah, I think it would be really tough on anyone.
Looking today now, so going forward from the time you were playing in, into the modern era, how would you describe hockey's current relationship and attitudes towards being gay and the LGBTQ plus community? Do you think it's improved, or do you think there's still problems there that, that they need to work with to be more inclusive?
From what I can see, it's improved greatly. And I think, you know, with Kate and Helen Walsh, I think it was just, you know, it's refreshing to see people talk about their relationship and it be a non-issue. And I think that's, you know, that's what it's all about. You don't see that in men's sport. You know, it's very strange how, and it's still, you know, today, there's a complete difference between women's sport and men's sport, or women in society and men in society, which is interesting. So, but from a hockey society, a hockey association, I think they've got absolutely right. I think they've moved with the times, moved fast with the times, which is great. So there'll still be biases in communities, but there are about everything. But it is certainly much, much better and stronger and easier for people just to be themselves and not have to pretend to be something else. So
do you think the men's side, not necessarily with hockey, but generally within sport, do you think that has still got a bit more work to do?
Absolutely. I think it's so sad. You know, and we don't know. It becomes a bit of a, you know, there must be some gay players in the Premier League. There probably are, but, you know, why? It's such a sad thing that they can't come out, and they shouldn't feel the pressure to come out, because if we're asking the question, there is pressure. You know, there's fear there. And when there's fear, there's still hate. When there's hate, we've still got a lot of work to do. So I think it's just a shame. I think it's a huge shame. I think, you know, hopefully it will change. And I think it's going to take a few more years to change, but I think once it does happen, I think it will be a lot more relaxed, and it won't be an issue, and it shouldn't be.
Did you ever officially come out to, like, the press, or did it just become known?
I think as a gay person, you come out several times, but I from a press point of view, I never spoke to any press during that time about my relationship. I remember what, you know, and it was only quoted from what I remember once, as far as, you know, there was a woman I knew was doing the interview, and she made some comment at the end, which was like, okay, fine, you just outed me. It wasn't talked about really. And, you know, I never, you know, we never sort of came out to anyone in hockey, that people just knew and just got on with it. So, different. And my parents, you know, I didn't actually. Have I ever come out to my parents? I don't even know if I have, but they know. Well, I'm obviously married now. But it was, again, because from the time, it was just people knew, so you didn't have to tell them. And nowadays, you know, at work, I have to tell people, which is fine, because it's easy now.
So when that woman, if you don't mind me asking, when she mentioned that comment at that press conference, how did that make you feel? Did you just kind of let it slip, or did you respond to her comment?
It was in the sort of written press. It was in, I think, one of the hockey magazines.
Okay.
So, yeah, and at the time they didn't sort of send you a copy before they released it, and it sort of just, it was in print and that was it. So, yeah, there weren't many times that we were sort of interviewed live. It was only after sort of a couple of games, and nothing was ever mentioned. It was all about the sport.
So just going on hockey generally then, now, is there a team or a player that you particularly remember that was really good to play against and with?
Yeah, there's lots of players that I've loved playing. Certainly I prefer people in my own team. So somebody like Sandy Lister, to play in her team is great. To play against her, you know, completely annoying. Same with Kate Parker. So it's Kate Parker's 60th birthday party this weekend.
Aww.
And she is a fantastic, committed, skillful, or was, player. And, you know, very, very pro the team that she's playing for, which is great when you're in that team. When you're playing against that, you know, it's just, she is just, that's the worst thing you can have, because she does wind you up. You know, it's really, really hard. So lots of good players. I like playing against Tina Cullen, just because certainly when she was younger, I could put her off shooting. So that always was quite good. Then she got a bit too good for that. But yeah, I like playing against skillful players. I liked playing against, I think I'm still playing, I'm talking, you remind me, I've gone back a generation or a couple. Yeah, lots of different players. Karen Brown, you know, was very skillful, great to train against. Yeah, lots of different players. I mean, there's internationally, you know, all of the Dutch players were absolutely fantastic, you know, great high levels of skill. And you could substitute one name for another name and they would just carry on, you know, being as good as they were. Yeah, the names escape me, but so many of the internationals and local, you know, UK players as well.
Do you have a standout memory from your career within hockey?
I think probably standing on the medal podium in Barcelona. Mm. And I think, you know, there's two things. There's a photo of us all looking absolutely just so happy, holding the flowers with a medal around our neck. But actually that feeling, you know, we'd felt nothing like it before. The team before in Seoul had come forth. So there was a lot of that team in the Barcelona team. So that was just amazing. The party we had that night was the best. And yeah, for me, it was those kind of moments. But then even, you know, even some of the, you know, the club hockey games when we'd win with Slough or with Ipswich and, you know, we'd stay up all night, but we'd obviously finish about 12. It was, you know, just magical to experience it. And as, you know, we travelled to a lot of different places. We had, you know, lots of fun. You know, lots and lots of fun and lots of laughter, you know, different things we did. Juvenile really, but just, it was just, you know, memories created from the simple things like pinning Pricey to the floor and shaving one of her legs, because as a strong feminist, she wouldn't shave her legs, so we decided to just shave one of them for her. But just, you know, just silly things like that, just pranking around and just having fun. Yeah, there were times where we borrowed the minibus from the coaches, and one time that Lisa Bayliss put it into R because she thought that meant ride, and it was reverse. So she backed into a building and then having to come back into the camp with a dented minibus and a find some excuses why that happened. So just a lot of fun. I mean, we always went out, we always did things, we always went to different places. So that's why the balance is nice, you know, be too serious.
And on the flip side of that then, is there anything that you regret from your time playing or that you find particularly disappointing when you look back and remember?
I'm disappointed in my own attitude some point. I'm disappointed I didn't just enjoy the whole thing a lot more at the sort of international level. I look back, I think, I mean, I did coach a little bit after I finished playing, but I was also quite, it was 25 years of playing, I'd had enough, you know, and I sort of walked away from the sport a little bit. And I think I could have given more back into the sport, especially to the goalkeepers. So I did a little bit of coaching. I was living near Ipswich at the time, and I was doing a bit of coaching in Ipswich and in Chelmsford as well. But actually, yeah, probably that's the thing I regret. I took a lot and I didn't give a lot back, though, and I think I could have done more.
Yeah. You've mentioned so many names throughout this interview, which is great. So it shows that you've made a lot of like friends within hockey. Do you still keep in touch with them? You mentioned you're going somewhere today for a 60th birthday party, but is there a lot of friends that you've stayed in contact with from your time playing, both internationally and at club level?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Sandy Lister and Vicky Dixon are both local, so I go for dog walks with Vicky. Sandy is one of my closest friends, so we're going to the Solheim Cup in a couple of weeks with Sandy. People from Slough, yeah, so Mandy Potto was always, you know, still a friend. Lots of different people. And it's nice, we've now got a Slough Old Girls WhatsApp group. And again, you know, if you just scroll through some of the messages, it just takes you right back, because it's, again, it's just about teasing each other and just taking the mickey out of each other. And everyone's got their own character and they kind of play up to it. So I would say probably, you know, 50% of my friends are hockey based. And the magical thing, though, is even, you know, even if you haven't seen somebody for 30 years that you played with, you see them and you can start to, you know, the bond is still there. It's just a lovely feeling. So any reunions that you have, it's just lovely to see the people that you played with or you played against. And because people are so much nicer now, because you just, like any sport, you know, there's, you will think certain things about different people and how they played, and they say we're rough or whatever, but actually meeting them and actually speaking to people, all of that's gone. You know, it's just friendship, whether you played in the same team or against people. So yeah, a good group of people, a good sport to actually connect people. And lots of friends still.
And you've mentioned this briefly about your involvement with hockey today. So do you not play anymore at all?
No, I don't play at all. I mean, I gave up playing a long time ago. So I gave up in sort of, I think in about 98, 99. I dreamt about it for years after I gave up, and it was the strangest dreams. You know, I convinced myself I could still play in my head. So almost every night I would dream about hockey or dream about packing a bag, because that's what we seem to be doing permanently, moving from one hotel to another hotel. Never played. I've played a couple of games where they've had, you know, England, not England Masters, but sort of a reunion type match. That was quite a long time ago. Looking at the England Masters, and they're doing such a fantastic job, and Sarah Bamfield, who played for Ipswich, at some point, you know, they won the World Masters, I think it's over 55, and the Euros in Birmingham just this year. So that, you know, fantastic achievement, but I couldn't do that now.
Is there anything else that you'd like to mention that we haven't talked about? Any memories you want to share, or just anything else you'd like to add?
Do you know that? My mind's gone blank now.
That's okay. We have talked about a lot throughout your career, so...
I think you've made my head spin now, because I'm thinking about all these things. No, I can't think of anything.
No, that's absolutely fine. That's no problem. But that's everything. That's all our questions for today. Just want to say thank you for taking the time to speak with me. And it's been really lovely hearing all your stories and your life experiences.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.